This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Okay, so today I'm speaking to Dr. Amanda Karakas from the Australian National University. Thanks for joining us on Jodcast.
That's okay, it's great to be here.
You've just given a really interesting talk on heavy elements in red giant stars. So before we get into details of that, could you tell us a little bit about your research and sort of what areas of physics interest you?
Right, so I'm interested in how stars evolve and how they make elements inside their interiors. And so I guess I'm a theorist. I have done some observations, but I tend to make theoretical models of low and intermediate mass stars. So stars like our sun, up to about 10 times the mass of our sun.
Awesome. So you said you're interested in heavy element formation. How do these elements form in the sun? And do different elements form in different ways? Or is there a cycle, different mechanisms, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so it depends on what we mean by heavy elements. So in particular, I'm interested in how all elements are formed. So this is really elements heavier than lithium, in fact. And so there are different types of nuclear reactions that take place in stars that can make these elements. But if we focus on what I call the heavy elements, these are elements heavier than iron, and these are formed in stars mostly through neutron capture reactions.
And can we clear something up very quickly? Mm-hmm. In this sort of science, metal means something different to what most people would call a metal. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it really does. In fact, astronomers, I think, are quite lazy in the sense we think everything that's, well, I guess stellar astronomers in particular, maybe other astronomers less so, but we think anything that's not hydrogen and helium is a metal.
Okay.
So a very simplistic view, really.
But then if you're looking at really heavy stuff, then that's more similar to the metals that we know of.
That's exactly right. Although, yeah, we tend to, then I'm interested really in nuclei, and then we have to consider hundreds of nuclei, and then we're really interested in the details. And these really are traditional metals in some sense.
There are traditional elements that form on Earth and that we can make on Earth in colliders and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But then there's all sorts of crazy physics that goes on in the centre of stars. Are there a lot of things that you could never form on Earth that exist there?
Yes, probably not in the sort of stars I'm interested in, though, actually. So stars like our sun, and up to, roughly, say, 8 or 10 times the mass of our sun, some of them will form unstable elements in their deep interiors when they're red giant stars. So not like our sun today, but when it becomes a red giant. But most of them don't deviate too far from stable isotopes. However, in exploding, for example, supernova or colliding neutron stars, there's all sorts of exotic scenarios for making the heaviest elements in nature, such as uranium and thorium. We think we might be able to make super exotic things we haven't even detected in the laboratory.
Wow. Okay. So, and what are the effects that these heavier elements have on the life cycles of stars and maybe even on the host galaxies?
Again, yeah. So if we just focus on elements heavier than iron, they actually don't change the stars themselves too much, because all of the reactions that take place in these stars are not energetically important. So a neutron capture reaction, for example, it produces very little energy, unlike hydrogen burning, which when it takes place, it produces, we use obscure units, we use mega electron volts. It produces roughly 26 mega electron volts. I can't remember right off the top of my head what that is in joules, but it's something like 10 to the minus 12 joules. But of course, our sun does a hydrogen burning reaction roughly 10 to the 38 times a second. That's how we get the solar luminosity out. So hydrogen burning is an efficient way of making energy inside a star, because you have 4 hydrogens make 1 helium nuclei. Whereas in the neutron capture reactions that make the really heavy elements don't produce very much energy. They don't change the structure of the star, so they won't have anything to do with how it lives or dies, essentially. They're just made, and then somehow the star will release that into the galaxy. How galaxies change as a result of it? I don't know if the galaxy itself will change so much as a result of the heavy elements, again, the very heaviest elements, but they will become more abundant with time.
And when generations of stars form, and different generations will have different amounts or yields of these heavy elements because they've been formed in the past, then they get blown out and then more stars form and they incorporate these. Are there any significant differences compared to a young star?
There can be. For example, the outer halo, so the halo of our galaxy, we think formed first, and that has a very low metal abundance. And again, now we're talking about anything that's not hydrogen, helium. So for example, the average metallicity, and that is again, it refers to the amount that's not hydrogen, helium. The average metallicity in the halo is roughly an order of magnitude less than in our sun. It's a bit more than that, actually. Maybe 30 times less metals than in our sun. So we do think that there is a difference in the metal content of old systems. Now, there are some caveats. Of course, the bulge of our galaxy is also considered very old. And we think that the bulge of our galaxy, however, is quite metal rich. So it more has a metallicity close to our sun. There's a spread, of course, in iron content, but we think it's very similar to our sun. So chemical evolution is complicated because it relies not just on stellar yield, so how much of an element star makes, but how quickly stars form and die as well, and the types of stars that form and die.
And that brings us to your research. Mm-hmm. So you simulate element formation in these stars, is that correct?
That is right. So I make theoretical models, so theoretical predictions of how much of a given element a star or a particular mass and composition makes over its lifetime.
And how do you model one of these systems? A star is a huge thing, and it's, what do you do? Yeah.
It's a good question. So we have a set of differential equations. It all comes down to mass, essentially. So we have a set of differential equations that we solve on a computer. How we do it really depends on the physical assumptions we make. We generally assume that the stars are spherically symmetric, which means we only have one space coordinate. So we have, and we usually use it in the mass as the independent variable. So when we make a model of a star, we're solving from the interior of the star outwards to its center, and then we will evolve that forward in time. And we make some assumptions about what sort of nuclear reactions take place inside its core. We also make some assumptions about the initial composition of the star, how the mass is lost, if we're doing massive stars, how the explosion happens. These generally tend to be quite simplified, because stars are very complex things that cover many orders of magnitude in reality.
Cool. And you mentioned the core. Is this where most of the reaction takes place then, right? In the
yes,
center?
That's right.
So, could you give us an example of the sort of scale of that? How big is the core compared to the rest of the star?
So that's a good question. So thermonuclear reactions are very temperature sensitive. So they quickly drop off as a function temperature. So really, in our sun, it's probably only 10% of its mass is where the nuclear reactions happen. I'm giving an approximate number here. So in terms of the radial scale, I don't know, because I don't tend to think of a star in terms of its radius. I know that seems very strange, because stars, especially when we talk about red giant stars, they're really centrally concentrated. So the example I gave in my talk today is that if we have a red giant star, the core where all the nuclear reactions happen is roughly, if we scale that to the size of a marble, in terms of radial scale, to get to the outer layers, it's 500 meters away. So I'm really only interested in what happens in the layers in that marble. So that's why mass is such a more useful variable, if you like.
That's a really weird thing to think about, because a red giant is huge, isn't it?
Mm.
But then does that mean that most of the matter is all in this very tiny core and it's very diffuse?
Not most of the mass. So again, So that example before was a radial scale.
Mm.
The mass scale is a little bit different. So let's say, if our marble is now, if we think in terms of the masses in each region, then so let's say we have a 3 solar mass star initially, so 3 times the mass of our sun. That core, that marble might have about 0.6 solar mass, and the envelope might be 2.4 solar mass.
Okay, so not too different.
That's why mass is a much better variable to use.
Okay.
As opposed to...
To measure the scale.
Exactly, and what's happening inside it.
Cool. And... Are there any problems that you come across? Well, this is a big, complex thing. You've got to make some assumptions and that sort of stuff. Are there any sort of bottlenecks to this? Are there any big problems that you have or assumptions that you have to make that make it more difficult to do this?
Yes, there's lots of problems. So I mentioned there are a number of simplifying assumptions that go into the simulations. And sometimes it's clear from... What we want to do is simulate reality. So we want to be able to make a model, a prediction that will match or at least compare well to a real star. So we often, for example, something I'll do, I will try and say, okay, I want to be able to simulate what the composition of a star looks like. So how much carbon it has, how much barium it has. And I compare this to real stars of the same evolutionary state. So stars that are all red giants. And one thing we do find that there are some problems, and we think these come down to the way that we treat stars. We assume they're all single stars, and we assume that they're all, and we have this idea of spherical symmetry. So one of the problems I've been looking at recently, and that I find really interesting, is how a companion star affects how we think stars change and evolve in time. And one thing we know is that, so our sun doesn't have a companion. It has planets, but it doesn't have a companion star. But most stars in the night sky, most sun-like stars have a companion, up to 50, 60% of them. And we know that they have a big effect, that they can have a big effect on whether a star becomes a red giant and what sort of red giant it'll become. And so that's something I've been working on recently.
Cool. And if we go back very quickly, how is it that you measure the elements in a star to compare your models to that?
Okay, that's not something that, that's a very good question. So we don't, of course, there are two ways we can do it, and they're quite complementary. So the main way that we do it is through stellar spectroscopy. So we measure stars' light, and we can break it down into its constituent parts, and we can, depending on the temperature of the star and its brightness and its evolutionary state, we can measure spectral lines. So these are absorption lines or emission lines in the star's spectra, and then from that, and some magic that involves knowing things about atomic data in stars and knowing how the stellar atmospheres work in stars, we can derive an elemental abundance. Usually only elements. It's very hard to get isotopic ratios from stars. But it is possible for some elements, such as carbon, magnesium, and even a couple others. So usually stellar spectroscopy, and usually you want, depending on, again, the sort of star, usually you want to have a nice big telescope with a nice sensitive spectroscope on there. The other way we can do it is it's through looking at bits of meteorites. And you might think, how do you get information from a star, from a meteorite? So we found that the oldest meteorites that we find on our planet, they're called carbonaceous chondrites. So these are very unprocessed meteorites. They're old. They're almost as old as our solar system. And they have these tiny bits of stardust inside them that when we break down a part of the meteorite, we find a little bit of this silicon carbide grain or graphite grains or diamond grains, spinel, all sorts of things. And when we measure the isotopic ratio of these stardust grains, we find they are very different to the bulk of our solar system in composition, but they match, oddly enough, some of the spectroscopic data we get from stars. And so we think, okay, these are bits of stardust. And so we can use these two in a complementary way to learn information about what's happening in real stars.
So what's happening in stars that we can see at the moment, and what happened in stars that have already gone supernova?
Or become red giants. Because most of the stardust grains, in fact, so there are two main sources of stardust grains. One are red giant stars, so stars like our sun will become when it evolves. So this will never become a supernova. It'll be a planetary nebula when it dies. Or the other main source are supernova explosions. So these two, probably the red giants contribute a little bit more, maybe 70% of the grains we detect.
Cool. And that was going to be my very last question. You mentioned our sun, mm-hmm. So a planetary nebula. Could you talk us through what we know about our sun and what's mm-hmm. going to happen to it as it ages, and what's going to happen to us, maybe?
Yeah, that's a good question. People have made a lot of models to try and predict what will happen to our sun when it dies, and what will happen to our solar system as well when it dies, when our sun becomes a giant. So our sun is roughly halfway through its life. It's going to live for about 10 billion years, and it's about 4.5 billion years old now. So it's got another 5 billion years of main sequence, which is hydrogen burning in its core. Will life be possible? So we expect that the sun, as the sun's aging, it's becoming brighter, and maybe in about 2 or 3 billion years, it might be too bright to sustain life on this planet. That's a guess. 2 or 3 billion years, maybe, or four, maybe. So there are some uncertainties in that number, but, you know, a couple billion years. This is before the star becomes a giant. It'll run out of hydrogen, and then the core will shrink, the outer layers expand, and depending on the calculations, most people predict that it probably won't. It'll reach close to the Earth at that point, but not quite to the Earth, maybe up to 50, 100 times the radius it is now.
So the size of the star will almost swallow the Earth within its radius?
Probably not at that point, but it'll go through, because a star like our sun will go through, it'll become a red giant twice. And it's when it becomes a giant the second time that it'll definitely swallow the Earth, for sure. And at that point, then all the outer layers will eventually blow off, and you'll end up with this hot core that can ionise that surrounding nebula. And then you'll see there's a planetary nebula. But that's probably, it'll spend about a billion years or longer on the red giant. So that's about 6 billion years from now.
So we're a long way off. Okay.
We are a long way off. Yes.
Cool. Well, thank you again. I think that's all we've got time for. Thank you for joining us. And hopefully we'll have you on the Jewelcast again.
Right. Thanks.
Cheers.